Joe Biden is going to have a comprehensive program and a comprehensive plan of implementation because we have aging infrastructure, we have some stranded assets that need to be repowered, and we've got to figure out how we build the cities of the future in terms of having microgrids, in terms of being resilient, in terms of being reliable and operated on 100% renewable energy with technologies that support that reality.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics.
I am David Wortmann. Voters in the US have decided Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States of America. And with him, we will see one of the largest clean energy agendas in the world. What can we actually expect from the new Biden administration? Are chances high that now the US will unite behind the fight against climate change? I have talked about this and many more questions with Angelina Galiteva. As a chairwoman, she is leading the board of the California Independent System Operator. It is one of the largest system operators in the world, which also ranks first in the US as a producer of electric coming from renewable energy. I've known Angelina for almost 20 years. We have always worked together to leverage experiences from both sides of the Atlantic. Whether we met Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to advise him how to lead California towards an ambitious renewable energy program, or we worked with European politicians to develop the renewable energy policies in Europe. Join this discussion of Let's Talk Change and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Enjoy. Hi, Angelina. It's such a pleasure to have you here in our Let's Talk Change podcast. We are usually reaching out to European audience here, and we have had recent developments in the US. So how have you been feeling now? In the first week of November, there was the presidential election. By now, it's pretty clear that Joe Biden has won the election. How were your emotions during that first week when everything was still in the limbo?
Well, when everything was in limbo, we were in limbo too. So most of the time, I think, like many other people similarly situated to myself, we just hid under the bed and tried to wait for the election results to come in, and then slowly came out as more and more positive news came along. And it's been a relief. It's been great. We're hoping to have much more clarity in where the energy policy is going, specifically with respect to decarbonization and the green agenda, and having a focus on science and progress and technology and infrastructure, which we all believe, and especially myself as well, is going to be very positive and in line with the European direction as well. So it's nice to be realigned in a positive energy system and future, because all of us live on this planet and we need to tackle the problem together.
Yeah, that's so great that the US seems to join the game now. You just mentioned the European Green New Deal, where Europe has promised to become carbon neutral until 2050. China has also announced to be carbon neutral until 2060. And now Joe Biden went out there and promised to do a $2 trillion investments in clean energy and jobs, right?
Correct.
He wants to turn the US carbon neutral until 2050. Tell us more about the program, about what he plans to do.
Well, hopefully with a focus on being carbon neutral by 2050, it will mirror closely to what California is doing as well, because California has also committed, one of the first states actually, to commit to being carbon neutral and 100% renewable energy for all sectors by 2050. So we've been working on that and putting plans together to ensure that we can have the transition in terms of technology, policy, and finance. So Joe Biden is going to have a comprehensive program and a comprehensive plan of implementation because we have aging infrastructure, we have some stranded assets that need to be repowered, and we've got to figure out how we build the cities of the future in terms of having microgrids, in terms of being resilient, in terms of being reliable, and operated on 100% renewable energy with technologies that support that reality. So the building sector, the transportation sector, the fuel sector, and industry has to have intricate and very detailed plans of how they're going to ensure that that transition happens in the most optimized fashion, in the most efficient fashion, and accelerate it so that it becomes a reality faster rather than later. And we take away the argument that this is too expensive, right? Because all the naysayers of green energy and new technologies always say, oh, this is going to be too expensive, because they look at it in an absolute manner. They never compare that the status quo and the fossil technologies cost just as much and actually much more when you bring in environmental externalities such as healthcare costs, such as environmental pollution, such as air and water pollution, and the remedies that we have to take as a society to fix these issues, because they're decoupled from the pollution that the energy sector imposes on us. So Joe Biden being able to build an infrastructure and build a policy and a focus and actually a story that society can understand and support and enthusiastically follow. And I think the young generation is there. We need to ensure that we have a just transition for some of the people still working in the fossil industries, but I'm confident that can happen.
So there's a pretty good window of opportunity now, since yes. You mentioned the infrastructure is aging, so reinvestments needs to be done anyway. So why shouldn't you then do it on a clean energy path, right?
Like Joe Biden says, build better.
Yes. So but people are still wondering over here. I mean, this is a very bold program. As we mentioned, $2 trillion investments. He wants to end every fossil fuel subsidies. He wants to ban new oil and gas permits on public land, right? But I think the questions we have over here in Europe is that the president, at the end of the day, cannot push everything through as well, right? He needs to have some majority in the Senate, some majority in the House of Representatives. If I'm correctly informed, the majority in the House of Representatives is there with the Democrats, but not in the Senate.
Not yet.
Not yet. So you're still hoping that the majority will be there soon.
Well, there's two elections in Georgia that are going to a runoff. If one of them wins, yes, there will be. So we have to wait until January 5th for the runoff to see where that happens. But David, as you know full well, the way green energy wins is one, first having policies and policies in place that ensure that there's market growth and that there's security in terms of investment and that the investment community knows that there's going to be a rate of return that can support what they need to have happen. So once you have a policy in place and once you have the technology starting to flow in with economies of scale, the prices start to come down. So if you look back over the last 20 years, what has happened is that renewables and related technologies are now the lowest cost technologies. So it is no longer an argument of this costs too much. This is an argument of renewables are the cheapest. Renewables are the lowest cost and highest value. The issue is making sure that we can support an energy system and all the other related industries 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, every single hour of the day. And that's where the challenge lays. But it's no longer an economic argument. It's more a reliability and operations argument. And I think we have the technologies to get past that.
Right. And already in the US, I mean, you have the proof points, right? You have a lot of large-scale solar PV, for example, implemented, I think with, I don't know, maybe something like 3 or 4 cents per kilowatt hour on production costs. Which is less than oil and gas. But still, Trump was running on a ticket that renewable energy wouldn't work. They're too expensive. And still, I think close to 78 or 80 million US Americans voted for Mr. Trump. So do you think that, as you mentioned a little earlier, that there needs to be just a better narrative to frame the developments of renewable energy? Or will be people just biased, like in the climate change issue in the US as well? And this will stay like that? Or do you think it's possible to overcome that?
God, I hope we can overcome that. I'm sure we can overcome that. I mean, looking from a California perspective, California transitioning to renewables and in many instances operating in very high level of penetration of renewables, just like Germany, has still kept an economic advantage, is the fifth largest economy in the world, and is doing well, and we're growing. So it can be done. And we have an example in the US of where you can see that that can be done. We also have an example in the middle of the US with Mid-American, where they're transitioning also to 100% renewable energy with wind power, because it is the lowest cost and it is the highest efficiency. And in many cases, when you look at it, Mid-American is the largest taxpayer in the state as well, and the farmers love it. So if you're able to organize the markets and you have the technologies and you've got companies and energy companies pushing for the renewables because they have secure operation and are a lower cost, then why not? So again, it's going to be a jobs argument. It's going to be an economic development argument. It's going to be a climate argument. It's going to be a this is the best for the future and our children argument. But ultimately, it's going to be we can operate a grid, we can operate a system, we can operate a transportation infrastructure based on a decarbonized energy system. And I think that story is going to be something that people start buying in, and especially if you take the fear away, oh, well, what are the miners going to do? Compared to workers in the solar sector and compared to workers in the clean energy sector, there are much fewer miners left. And I will tell you that 9 out of 10 and maybe even 10 out of 10 miners just want a good job. They don't necessarily want to be on the ground digging. They want to have a good job that pays them well in an industry that creates energy or creates a benefit for society. So giving a path for the just transition of the workers in the fossil industries, whether it's gas, whether it's coal, or whether it's even internal combustion engines, is going to be very important. And I think we have examples that we can point to in Europe, but also in California. The largest employer in California is Tesla, which is the manufacturer of electric vehicles. And the solar industry right now in California employs more people than all of the investor-owned utilities combined. So the jobs are in the clean tech sector. And it's a technology-driven industry, as you well know, which of course then allows for manufacturing to start becoming an argument as well, because the US can become a hub for manufacturing the green technologies of the future.
But still, there seems to be a division running through the US, right? At least on the climate issue. Is this something you think you will overcome as well, or that the minds are cooling down now after 4 years of Trumpism and people will start to look at the science and the facts again? And then at the end of the first Biden administration, we will maybe have more unity around the topic of climate issue and for the energy transition.
I think over time, all of us around the globe have started to feel climate. It's not longer believing whether climate change is happening. It's witnessing that it is happening. We have many more winter storms. We have many more fires. In California, the fires were specifically caused by climate change. Mm-hmm. We have more hurricanes. We've got destruction happening because of climate change. So mitigating the effects of climate change also strengthens our economies and our resilience. So not only are renewables carbon-free and lowest cost, they have a dual benefit of helping us mitigate climate change. So the faster the world can transition to decarbonizing their economies in every sector, starting with the electricity sector, because electricity will become the foundation, whether it is the hydrolysis for hydrogen, whether it is charging batteries, whether it is pumping pumped hydro, you've got to have a strong decarbonized electricity sector that can then charge the transportation sector, the fuel sector, industries, and life in general.
I think we should point out that you have really been a big, big advocate and ambassador for renewable energy in the US and actually across the world as well. You have been appointed to the board of the California Independent System Operator, CAISO, in 2011 by the Californian Governor Jerry Brown. Right. And CAISO is the largest independent system operator. And throughout the last years, under your leadership and guidance, if I'm correctly informed, more than half of the energy running through your system is already generated by renewable energy. And I think we also should mention that very recently, and now in 2020, you even became the chair of this board as the first woman. And you are now overseeing one of the largest and probably the largest independent system operator in the world with that. So what kind of responsibility you feel here, and what are the next milestones? What do you need to get to possibly 100% renewable energy within your area of responsibility?
This is very exciting. And then having been a part of the CAISO now since 2011, appointed by Governor Brown and now reappointed and being elected to the board, basically shows that we've been on the right path and we've become a beacon in terms of integrating renewables safely and reliably, and becoming an educator for other grid operators to come and receive training from the CAISO on how they can integrate renewable. And it becomes very positive as an example for people to turn around and say, well, if they can do it, we can do it too. And it can be done reliably. Actually, systems that rely on renewables have become more secure and they are more resilient in many ways as well, because a centralized power station, such as our nuclear power station, going off with 2,000 megawatts in a very constrained area causes many more reliability issues than small, scattered, distributed systems around the world or around the state not operating at the same time. So having a more distributed and a diversified system also makes a more resilient system. And another one of the initiatives that we have undertaken in terms of the Greater West, because the Western United States are not as integrated, there were 39 separate balancing authorities, is the ISO launching the energy imbalance market that has also driven the decarbonization of the Greater West. With more renewables coming online westwide, it has become clear that coal-fired power plants are not as efficient, and many of them are being closed down. And also many states, now a total of 17 states in the United States, have embraced the 100% renewable goal. And we believe that that was a result of California's bold leadership. So not only are we leading in the United States, where now over 30% of the U.S. population lives in areas committed to 100% renewable energy, but we're also giving confidence to the rest of the world that indeed this can be done and a system can be operated, and we should all transition in that direction because it's the most cost-effective solution for all of us. But as you well know, it is driven by policy. You need to have a dedication on a high political level, and California is blessed with having a leadership that is committed to deep decarbonization, 100% renewable energy, and carbon-free by 2050. So we've got to transition and ensure that we can operate our transportation and building sectors with 100% renewable energy. And to that effect, California has a mandate of all new construction incorporating solar, starting in 2020 with the residential sector, 2025 and 2030 with the industrial and commercial sectors respectively. And recently the governor signed an executive order banning the sale of internal combustion engines starting in 2035. So after 2035, only electric vehicles or emission-free vehicles, but not internal combustion engines, will be available for sale in California, which will also accelerate the market. And I think this is the right time. We now have enough electric vehicles, and they're at a price point of where they're cheaper than conventional vehicles at this stage of the game. And we have a renewable portfolio standard in California as well that focuses on new renewables and a specific type of renewables, such as solar, wind, geothermal. So large hydro does not count as part of the renewable portfolio sector. And also behind the meter individual owned solar is not counted behind the renewable portfolio standards as well, which means that if you add the hydropower and the behind-the-meter solar, which is going very, very fast in California at the rate of 10 to 12,000 homes per month, and now we have a new mandate that all construction for new homes should have renewables and solar on them, it's become even more exciting.
Maybe you can explain us a little bit more as well. What are the responsibilities and possibilities at the different policy levels? Because usually in Europe, you have strong responsibilities for the energy legislation by the national level. But in the US, it's not just the national level, right? So Mr. Biden's administration. But as you mentioned a little bit already as well, all these states. But apart from the federal states, also at the municipality level, and maybe I should mention as well that you have been executive director of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. And, you know, some years ago, you have put together one of the most ambitious solar energy programs at the municipality level in the United States. So tell us a little bit from your experience and what you expect as well from the coming years. Who should take over what kind of role and responsibility at the national, at the state, and the local level?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it's always the age-old question, do you go top-down in terms of policies, or do you build bottom-up in terms of grassroots movement, and then the grassroots movement translating into policy? And sometimes it's kind of a dynamic operation of both. With regards to the US, the federal level is a floor, so that's the minimum you have to meet, and usually California is well ahead of that. And states can go further than what the federal minimum is, as we have in terms of transportation and in terms of renewable energy. So California is saying that they're going to ban combustion engines, or having higher standards for operation of vehicles has always been the case, even though the Trump administration tried to challenge that authority of the state and tried to pull us back in terms of rewinding our clean transportation goals. And we're actually in a fight with them for that, which was very interesting. But you can have states that can have bolder and more aggressive goals, and you can have municipalities and regions that can have bolder and more aggressive roles. And it can be top down, like the state of California saying, we're going to decarbonize, but it can also be bottom up, where community choice aggregators have sprung out throughout the state based on communities and cities and municipalities saying that they want to transition to 100% faster, or have cleaner technology integration faster than what the state mandates. So yes, policies from the high level are very important, but when they're not keeping up with public demand, you also see the bottom-up movement coming very quickly and demanding that change happen faster. So municipalities such as the LA Department of Water and Power, which is one of the largest municipalities in the US, was able to have more progressive programs even than the state of California, because they do have that autonomy and they're governed by city councils. The CCA, the community choice aggregators, have taken that model where they're governed by city councils or several city councils combined together to be able to form their own agencies and determine their own energy future in building microgrids, in building renewables, in having more progressive electric vehicle transportation programs, and especially harnessing the power of demand energy response, and being able to bring storage and other technologies to support operations.
So to accelerate this dynamic, which you just described from multiple levels, is the Biden program enough? Or do we need some more, let's say, external events like another hurricane or another fire across California or something like that, so that people wake up and really understand the connection here between climate change and a clean energy development? Or do you think that we are now on the right path with this new Biden administration?
I think we're definitely on the right path. We don't have the detailed plans in place. You do need to have details and implementation plan. The devil is always in the detail. So taking that big picture and that wishful and kind of very progressive thinking and translating it into an action plan that you can implement on the ground, on the distribution level, and on the transmission level is going to be very important. So we've got the direction, we've got the commitment, now making sure that we translate it in the right way, and we have a set of regulatory reforms that push technological development without picking technological winners, but making sure that it's done on capabilities is very important. Also, looking through existing legislation, looking through existing structures in terms of energy agencies, in terms of cities, in terms of regions, and being able to coordinate all of those initiatives is very important. Sometimes aligning incentives and the programs that you're trying to implement is also important. So I think basically a review of all of our regulatory structures and of how our agencies are set up to be able to implement the new future is going to be very important. Because traditionally, as you know, the transportation sector and the building sector haven't been a part of the energy sector necessarily, right? They're separate silos. So now we have to learn to work across silos and ensure that all of these technologies and all of these systems can communicate with each other and work together well. whether it's an electric vehicle supporting the grid with ancillary services or storage, or whether it's a building being able to reduce demand energy requirements so that they don't peak the system and cause additional stress on the system. And even if you go into how we actually implement the changes in terms of building and the building trades and being able to cross-train people, because an auto mechanic now is essentially an electrical and an energy worker as well. A builder is going to have to be an electrician and understand electricity as well, because all new construction is going to incorporate not only generation such as solar, but possibly storage such as a power wall from Tesla, an electric vehicle charging station, and a very smart grid in the home, combining all the appliances and dispatching them as needed during various energy scenarios. So, I mean, the future is much more distributed, it's decentralized, it's decarbonized, it's democratized, it's digitized. And everybody, including the individual now, is a part of that infrastructure. Because until recently, it was basically a one-directional grid. We send you the energy, we tell you what the kilowatt-hour cost is, and you, as the ratepayer, pays it. Well, we are no longer just ratepayers. We're also customers, because we want programs that the utilities can provide. But we are also evolving, we as each individual, into prosumers, because we are also producing energy as well as consuming it and able to monetize not only our home as an asset, but the energy technologies that we decide to introduce into the grid to provide services, whether it's through aggregation or through something else. So customers are becoming much more engaged in making sure that, hey, if I'm investing in a solar system and I've got storage and I've got a vehicle, how can I dispatch all of these technologies to be able to support an infrastructure that can benefit from my investments and I can be paid for providing those services? So it has become a very complicated scheme, but a very interesting one and a very positive one. And I think that's going to start happening all over the world. And it's good for us that it does, because the energy companies now can rely on investments that each individual makes, right? Because we buy our solar system. So I, as a utility company, don't have to invest in it, but I can derive benefit from the individual investment of others and support the grid and be much more effective doing it, and everybody wins.
The US has left the Paris Climate Agreement, and Biden has promised to come back again and to rejoin. How do you see, let's say, everyday Americans looking internationally? Do they think that they will have, let's say, some exceptional path they are moving forward now with Biden's plan? Or do they see that across the globe there are other initiatives going on as well to push renewable energy, and that is sort of a, let's say, healthy competition the US should not miss?
Exactly. And I think if it is also a position such as this is something that is good for us, and it's good for us not just environmentally and for our future and for our children's future, but it's also good for us economically. Because building better will lead to more jobs, it will lead to better infrastructure, and it will lead to wider benefits for everyone. Everyone, as you know, looks through their own individual prism, right? So if their pocketbook is affected negatively, or they think it may be affected negatively, they'll react. So the name of the game is going to be to convince the public at large that transitioning to a carbon-free future is beneficial for them economically, short-term as well as long-term in terms of environment and opportunities for themselves and for their children. We've got to lay out that path of how to transition to a green infrastructure and a green New Deal, whether it's in the US, whether it's in Europe, whether it's anywhere else, is a transition to a better economic development reality for the whole country and from everyone involved, which is why, as I said, you need to bring in the unions, you need to bring in the infrastructure people, and you need to showcase how the workers of the fossil energy industry can transition to a new high-tech renewable energy industry, and how there are jobs for them and places for them and opportunities to retrain and become a part of that reality. With respect to the young people and for the workers of the future, I believe they're already there, and everybody is enthusiastic about embracing the possibility of making that happen and making it happen faster as well. Whether it's driverless cars, whether it is a whole new infrastructure for high-speed rail or fast transportation, We see the dynamics in the transportation sector already becoming a reality with the rideshare industry. So there's a dynamic change that is being embraced. And the issue is, what are the vehicles that we make this happen with? We all want to have energy in our homes. We all want to have access to the internet. We all want to ensure that that happens quickly and seamlessly. And if renewables and new technologies can provide that, then great. If our vehicles can take us from point A to point B just as fast, just as comfortably, and just as efficiently without oil and gas, then that's great. We can do it with the power of the sun. And it's even a much more appealing idea on a very basic human level. Your car being powered by the sun as opposed to polluting gas, why wouldn't you want that? You just don't want to compromise on cost, and you don't want to compromise on convenience, and you don't have to. So making sure that we start building these components here, which would be probably more difficult because we already have legacy industries in place to compete with, is going to be even more simple and even faster in countries where they're building that infrastructure now. So if you take a village in the middle of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, being able to electrify the community with renewables and storage, and with that bring education, bring infrastructure in terms of telecommunications, and therefore the kids can go to school, bring infrastructure in terms of empowering women and industry, and then ensure that you can have a carbon-free transportation system, and then connect to a larger grid as well. Nobody's saying you don't connect to a larger grid, but you don't require to build the grid before you're already electrifying a community that may be very distant from any potential of a grid coming in the next 10 years. Meanwhile, you can have them empowered with all the new technologies and leapfrog into the future almost overnight. And only renewables can do that. And again, the benefits of renewables, you're not polluting the air. And more importantly, you're not polluting the water. One of the largest polluters of freshwater resources after agriculture worldwide is the fossil industry. And that is something we need to grapple with as well.
Mm-hmm. So if we fast forward 4 years, what would the Biden administration realistically have achieved? And what would be the, let's say, the gap of what they have promised now?
Well, hopefully in 4 years, the Biden administration will have rejoined, of course, they will have rejoined the Paris Agreement, and collectively as a global society, we will have pushed for more stringent parameters of the climate agreement as well, because that needs to happen and more countries need to step up and ensure that they're aggressively decarbonizing. That we have a national policy for decarbonizing in the US and a national policy and plans of how each region and each area can achieve that. The National Renewable Energy Lab has already laid out a potential plan of how that can happen. I would hope that would be worked out on an infrastructure level in greater detail as well, with the cost and benefits associated with that, and a comprehensive work plan for not just training the workers of the future, but retraining the workers of the past as well to participate in that future. And also incorporating Native Americans. Native Americans are in a very precarious position. For instance, the Navajo, who occupied Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Nevada, and Utah, need to make sure that as we close the coal power plants in their territories, that energy is replaced with renewables. And they have come up with a declaration for renewable energy and supporting the general transition to 100% renewable energy as well, which I think is a very positive move and something that we should be focusing on. So each state carrying the flag forward and figuring out how to do it. Regional leadership as well, like we do in the West, incorporating the Native American communities also into that reality and empowering them and ensuring that they're participants. We need to harness hydropower to the extent possible, although recognizing that climate change will affect that as well. And most of all, hydrogen and storage technologies, because long-term storage and seasonal storage, when you're transitioning to an electrical system that is 80, 90% renewable and supporting other industries such as transportation and buildings as well, we need to ensure that we've got adequate storage to be able to meet every single hour of every single day, 365 days a year. And as reliable as the sun is, we know it comes up every day and it goes down every day. There is certain intermittency that needs to be addressed.
So wouldn't it be nice, Angelina? I remember, I think it was 2004 when the two of us, together with back then member of the German parliament, Hermann Scher, the three of us met Arnold Schwarzenegger, the then governor of California. And after our meeting with him, and of course, with a lot of, let's say, advisory work, which you have done as well to the California governor, the development really took off in California. Wouldn't it be nice that we set up soon a meeting with Joe Biden and his team and tell him a little bit more how we think the development could accelerate?
Yes, and there has always been a great relationship between the U.S. and Germany in terms of energy policy. I mean, we work together on the solar programs. We work together on incorporating renewables on the grid. We have always had a very good relationship with grid operators in Europe and especially in Germany. And we've worked together on the transportation sector and infrastructure as well. We're also sometimes in competition where we're heavy here in the U.S. on battery storage. And Germany and Europe has decided to focus a little bit more on hydrogen and potential of hydrogen storage so we can have cross-reference and learn from each other and leapfrog without having to make the mistakes that each one of us may have made respectively in batteries or hydrogen. So there's always been this very symbiotic, slightly competitive relationship. And I think we should continue it because we benefit from that collaboration and competition. But one more area where we could collaborate between Europe and the U.S., and that is starting to happen, is offshore wind. Offshore wind is also critically important in terms of accelerating our transition to 100% renewable energy and making sure that California can harness the potential of offshore wind, which coincides very nicely with our evening peak, is a very exciting proposition. And I look forward to us collaborating on that as well.
Thank you very much, Andrina. I think that was a very good call at the end of our conversation to have a healthy competition, but still work together to learn from each other. And yeah, let's catch up very soon as well. There are so many options and you are a very inspiring woman. And I think a very good example for many, many people out there. And I wish you good luck in leading California and beyond and now moving forward to the next stop, which should be 100% renewable energy. Thank you very much, Angelina.
Sure. Onwards and upwards. We only have progress to make, and we will get there in the electricity sector for sure. Let's decarbonize the other ones as well, and let's work together to make it happen faster. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Angelina.
Take care. Bye-bye, David. Bye.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international clean tech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.